Thanks for being with us here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin health officials are reporting another jump in the number of positive COVID-19 tests. Milwaukee County has the most cases, followed by Dane. And the number of deaths in Wisconsin caused by COVID-19 stands at 10. We have Wisconsin's chief medical officer here to discuss the state's attempt to flatten the curve, the goal being to avoid a sharp uptick of cases and instead elongate the outbreak so hospitals can keep up. Have you been tested? What was your experience? Are you supportive of the stay-at-home order? What additional actions do you think the state and federal officials should take right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Ryan Westergaard is chief medical officer and state epidemiologist for communicable diseases for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Dr. Westergaard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for inviting me back.
Let's first look at testing. Some healthcare facilities were initially unable to test for COVID-19 due to a lack of tests. What now is our capacity here in Wisconsin?
Well, fortunately, our capacity has increased quite a bit just in the past week. So we at the Department of Health Services do surveillance on an ongoing basis. So all test results that get reported to clinicians also come to our system electronically. And as of this week, we're receiving about 2,000 test results a day, and we've received lab reports from about 40 different laboratories in the state, and that's an increase from just two a little over a week ago when our public health labs were able to use the CDC test. So test capacity is increasing.
We heard from a doctor in Eau Claire yesterday saying that it was taking a week to get test results back. Is there a lag time? What are the delays for getting results?
Yeah, with getting tests right now, because it's a specialized test that can only be done in certain laboratories, does involve a turnaround time of a couple days at the minimum. And that's because specimens need to get transported, sometimes overnight, and then the machinery that's running these tests it takes a long time, and there's a multi-step process. So the minimum turnaround time of 1 or 2 days is under the best circumstances. And in the setting of the last week where there was a limited number of labs and the capacity is still being built up, we were forced to prioritize testing for patients for whom the information was really urgently needed. And that turned out to be hospitalized patients and healthcare workers who were on the front lines. So at our two public health laboratories, we developed some priorities that resulted in some of patients who are recovering at home or have mild symptoms being less, lower in the queue, and then there was a longer turnaround time. We're hoping that issue takes care of itself as technology improves, as manufacturing of test reagents improves. But because of the nationwide crisis, there's a shortage of all sorts of different necessary equipment and ingredients for these tests. So we're vulnerable for having these delays going forward. But right now, we think the test capacity is increasing, and we're optimistic that it'll continue that way.
And Wisconsin has a new testing task force. What does that entail?
Well, the goal ultimately is to have the lowest barrier, the lowest threshold for testing in as many settings as we can. And at the very beginning, it was just in these highly sophisticated tests. But as technology improves, we're going to be able to do it as point-of-care tests. As some people might be familiar with getting a test for the flu or for strep throat in the office testing, and also in untraditional venues. There's been wide attention to non-traditional testing venues in places like South Korea, where people can drive up and get tested. So at the State Emergency Operations Center, they've created a task force to really take inventory of all the various strategies that we can be using to get people tested who need testing, do so in a coordinated fashion, so we don't have the shortages that we've been struggling with in the first month of the epidemic.
Talking with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. You can join in. Healthcare workers, what do you need right now? Has your facility seen an increase in volume? How are you preparing to combat the pandemic? Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Westergaard, the stay-at-home order went into effect midweek. Are you seeing any positive results from that so far, or when would that kick in?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're cautiously optimistic, but we're also trying to communicate a sense of calm urgency to the public that if this works, we really need to all chip in and all participate in the stay-at-home order. So One of the concerning things about this epidemic that we've learned from other countries is that by the time we've detected it in a community, it's probably much more widespread than we realized. And this is because of the likelihood that people can have the virus and spread the virus with minimal symptoms. Now, for some people, it's a very lethal virus, and it's not always predictable who those individuals are. So when we test really the tip of the iceberg in terms of having hospitalized and sick people tested, it's often the case that there's a number of other people with minimal symptoms in the community already. That was really the early experience with this tragic situation in Washington State that affected a lot of people in long-term care facilities. So the idea of staying at home is to decrease overall on a large scale the close contact between people so the virus doesn't get a chance to spread through the community from people who have mild symptoms and really exponentially increase and really spread throughout the community. So that's in order for us to do that, it really takes large buy-in. In terms of when we would see the effect, right now, if we implemented that 100% or 90% effective in terms of reducing close contact, I would still expect we're going to see a peak in the coming weeks. And that's because people think can become infected and they're not develop symptoms for a period of 5 days to as many as 2 weeks. So even if we really implemented it well, we might still see them go up, and we expect to see the numbers of cases, the number of deaths go up. But our hope is that we'll reach that peak sooner, and the peak will be slower and lower than if we allowed business as usual and the normal amount of contact with people.
You probably saw this week the State Hospital Association put out some modeling estimates that the number of patients needing care will exceed our hospital capacity in 3 to 5 weeks. What can be done to increase capacity? What do you think of those estimates?
Well, the estimates are subject to a lot of limitations, and forecasting things like infectious disease epidemics is even more fraught with challenges than forecasting things like the weather, because one of the key parameters is human behavior, which is very difficult to predict. So we've looked at a number of diverse computer modeling strategies try to answer this question of what is the peak going to be, how many hospitalized or critically ill patients is going to be. And unfortunately, they're all telling us the same thing, which is that the capacity for hospital space and critical care beds is likely to be exceeded. So there's two things that we do for this. One is we're trying to grow capacity however we can. Most of our health systems have started to do this surge capacity where they've eliminated outpatient scheduled procedure, which normally use hospital rooms and ventilators so they can increase the capacity. We're looking at building additional facilities to care for people who have critical illness. We're looking to buy additional ventilators, though that's a challenge because this is a nationwide epidemic. But the other thing that I think we can't emphasize enough, that the peak, the degree to which these computer models predict reality, the key driver of this is how well we limit social interaction. That's how the virus gets amplified or magnified in the community. It's through close contact between people. So if we can all do that, if we can, for this next critical month, limit how frequently people are in the same space, breathing the same air, and pay attention to all the standard things like respiratory hygiene and close contact and hand washing when we are in public, we're going to minimize this surge and protect our healthcare resources.
We're talking about Wisconsin's approach to battling the coronavirus with the state epidemiologist for communicable diseases. Ryan Westergaard is here. Have you or a loved one contracted the coronavirus? Have you had to navigate the healthcare system? We want to hear from you. What's your experience been like? What are your questions about COVID-19 here in Wisconsin? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. We'll talk more in just a minute with Dr. Westergaard right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So the Wisconsin Hospital Association took stock. The state has 11,000 hospital beds, 2,600 ICU beds, and about 620 ventilators. Infrastructure here that is absolutely crucial when combating a virus that currently lacks preventative treatment. So healthcare workers, what do you need right now? How is your facility seeing an increase in volume? How are you preparing for the pandemic? Do you have adequate supplies? Tell us what you're seeing, 800-642-1234. Dr. Ryan Westergaard is Chief Medical Officer and State Epidemiologist for Communicable Diseases for the Department of Health Services, and he stays with us. Let's take a call now. Dave is with us from Menominee. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I work in a warehouse where we drive forklifts. We're doing laps down the aisles constantly for 8 hours. So the person in front of us is, we're breathing the jet stream from the person in front of us and vice versa in the person behind us. I was wondering if that was a risk to contract the virus.
Dave, are you wearing any protective clothing or gear as you work?
Nope. Just normal, you know, just, no, I'm not. None of us are.
Dr. Westergaard?
Yeah. Thanks, Dave, for that question. The risk of transmitting the virus is really requires the greatest risk is close contact, and we define that as between 6 feet. And the reason for that is the virus is most heavily concentrated in respiratory droplets, the kind of things that get generated when you cough and sneeze. So if you're in the same room with someone and further away from them at 6 feet, the risk is minimal. When you're sharing the same indoor environment, the risk of transmitting the virus through contaminated surfaces is also a concern, though. So that's the reason that we recommend hand hygiene and keeping frequently touched surfaces like doorknobs and tabletops clean as well. So to specifically answer your question, you know, breathing the same air in the situation you described would be a pretty minimal risk, but getting within close contact within 6 feet or, you know, two arm's length away is really what we define as close contact that puts you at risk of transmitting respiratory viruses.
Dave, thank you for the call. We heard from Mike in La Crosse, called in and wanted to say the state should be releasing how many tests are conducted so the public could better understand the rate of positive tests. Dr. Westergaard, does the state release these kind of numbers?
Yes, we do. So on our website at 2 p.m. every day, we update the number of tests that have been done that are both positive and negative. And so we can see, you can see the total volume of tests that has increased day by day. And so we've been reporting those numbers as we go.
And the volume right now, I mean, the number of tests that have been done exceeds about 10,000 the last I checked.
Yeah, that's true. The number of labs able to do tests is also going up. So, We're cautiously optimistic that with more technology coming online, we'll be able to keep up with the demand. And right now, there's not rationing per se. Any clinician who feels like their patient needs a test can order a test and have it done. We've had to prioritize testing in hospitalized patients at our public health labs that do fee exempt testing. But hopefully, we'll use a number of different strategies to get tests done more efficiently than we have been able to in the past.
Looking to Congress now, which is on the cusp of passing the $2 trillion stimulus package, and it includes $100 billion for hospitals, what might that mean for Wisconsin's healthcare system?
Well, there are critical shortages, as everyone is aware, of certain supplies, most notably personal protective equipment like masks, gowns, and gloves, which are really our mainstay of preventing transmission of respiratory viruses that are spread in the way that I described. So that infrastructure is really valuable. We're doing everything we can to prevent the need for this, but other critical care resources like mechanical ventilators and the equipment that goes along with supporting people on life support when their lungs are severely damaged are also things that we want to increase our capacity. Having funds to purchase those things would be helpful, but there is a nationwide shortage. So we're hoping that the federal resources can also stimulate other improvements in manufacturing sector to improve the supply of these critical resources.
So when you mentioned PPE there, as it stands today, do our Wisconsin hospitals have the supplies they need to combat the pandemic as we see it?
Well, as we speak, we hear from individual hospitals, they are in a contingency situation where many are using PPE like masks in ways that they don't normally do, meaning wearing masks for longer periods of time, not taking a new one on when you go into a patient room and then throwing it out when you leave and using another one for the next patient's room. So if that's done well, if people don't touch their masks, we have guidance about how to make PPE last longer. And many, if not most, hospitals are in that space right now where they're trying to conserve PPE by doing things that we think are equivalently safe, but not sort of usual behavior. What we're keeping a close eye on and what we're trying to get hospitals to keep staying in communication with us about is when do we actually get to sort of crisis levels where we have to do things that really aren't standard. And that tends to look like using non-standard masks, homemade PPE, things that we're reading about. We are not in a position where we're doing those non-traditional things that we think are less safe, but we're actively preparing and trying to prevent getting to that situation.
Are masks being reused by the same healthcare provider, the same physician or nurse during the day where you take the mask off and it gets sterilized?
So there are strategies for sterilizing masks after you've been wearing them for a period of time. Yes, the same mask can be worn longer throughout the day as long as it doesn't get visibly soiled or contaminated with your hands. So there's some best practices about using masks for a longer period of time than we normally do. Some hospitals, not hasn't been universally adopted, are using ultraviolet light to sterilize masks, wiping down face shields, which are important for preventing respiratory droplets from getting in your eyes with alcohol. So we're doing things that we think are safe that can make the PPE last longer right now and feel comfortable that it hasn't come at a cost to patient safety, but that's really the concern and why we're trying to really work on both sides, both the supply chain, trying where are we going to get extra PPE, and also the demand, which is to say, how can we use the PPE most wisely so we prevent getting into those crisis situations.
What about the status of ventilators in the state?
Well, as you mentioned, the Hospital Association and we at the Department of Health Services have queried the hospitals about the number of ventilators and the potential surge capacity. And we're trying to also do work on both ends of the equation. So using ventilators only in crisis, so we're postponing or canceling elective procedures, turning outpatient ambulatory procedure rooms into making those available for addressing caring for critical care patients. But also trying to be proactive about if we get to the situation where we have to make hard decisions about using ventilators or not using ventilators in places that we usually would, what's the best ethical framework for doing that? We really hope that we don't get there. The experience from New York is that they're very close to being there right now. So it's a very grave concern that the usual standard of anyone who has respiratory failure in the ICU gets a trial of a ventilator, we may get to a point where we have to do things differently. We may have to make decisions and involve other strategies for saying what's the best use of these ventilators so we can make them, put them to the wisest use to save the most people. And those are very hard discussions, and that's really a motivation for all of the prevention and the surge capacity things that we're doing so we don't have to make those hard decisions.
Talking with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Health Services here in Wisconsin. Russ in Stoughton. Hi, Russ.
Quick comment here. I've had the opportunity to talk to at least three different people in the last week or so who have had either friends or relatives with symptoms, the fever, the sore throat, the cough, go to various medical clinics, I don't know which ones, and were turned away actually by receptionists, not even a doctor or nurse, saying go home and take the best care of yourself you can because we don't have any tests.
Dr. Westergaard, what do you do if you are recognizing some symptoms?
The best thing to do is to call your doctor, your healthcare provider, and get advice. Most cases of COVID-19, like we talked about before, aren't going to require medical attention. And that's, you know, that's the good news, is that the majority of people can recover at home. And right now in our whole community-wide response to the epidemic, our recommendation is for everyone to stay out of contact and stay home as much as you can if it's safe. So people that have mild symptoms that don't require hospitalization, as long as they know how to get help and they know what warning signs to look for, which would be like if they get short of, increasingly short of breath or feel really uncomfortable or lightheadedness, you call 911 by all means, seek care urgently if it's a life-threatening situation. But for the typical respiratory virus that infection that everyone gets a couple times a year, runny nose, sore throat, body aches, if those symptoms are mild, the safest thing to do is recover at home and know who to call if they get worse. And
well,
we want to test more than we are, so we can understand where the epidemic is spreading. But right now, we really want to protect both patients and healthcare workers. The majority of patients we think can be cared for in the home setting should be cared for in the home setting.
Dr. Westergaard, thank you. Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The U.S. now has more confirmed cases of the coronavirus than any other country. Nationwide, the number of infections tops 85,000. At least 1,300 people have died from the virus. New York City remains the hardest hit area. NPR's Rob Stein says not enough testing's been done to get a true picture of how the virus has spread.
500,000 tests is still just a drop in the bucket in terms of what a huge nation like the U.S. really needs. And giving places a false sense of security could be dangerous. It could be kind of just setting the stage for them to become the next New York.
Next week, President Trump is expected to issue updated guidelines for social distancing. The U.S. Navy hospital ship Mercy is heading from San Diego to Los Angeles to help ease California's stressed healthcare system. As Hedy Lynn Hurdes reports, the Mercy will be used for surgeries and other critical care not related to COVID-19.
The 1,000-bed ship is expected to be a relief valve for local hospitals in Los Angeles that are currently swamped with both coronavirus and non-coronavirus cases. The California Health and Human Services Secretary says California, which has reported more than 3,000 cases and 67 deaths related to COVID-19, is expecting a large surge in patients over the next 2 to 3 weeks.
The Navy hospital ship Comfort will head to New York. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. With more testing available, the number of positive cases of COVID-19 in the state continues to grow. The State Department of Health Services announced Thursday there are 707 positive cases of COVID-19 statewide, as well as 11,583 negative tests. As of this morning, 12 people had died due to COVID-19. The latest data from the Department of Health Services show for every person who has tested positive for the new coronavirus in Wisconsin so far, 16 have tested negative. Megan Hart reports that healthcare professionals are expecting that ratio to change in the coming days.
Dr. Jeff Potthoff is Chief Quality Officer at UW Health. Currently, he says the sickest patients are prioritized when it comes to testing. Potthoff says healthcare workers and people in high-risk groups like those with heart or lung disease can also be tested with milder symptoms under the state's current guidelines. He says the ratio of positive to negative tests will increase as the virus continues to spread in Wisconsin.
And then as we get more into it here in Wisconsin, you'll see the percentage of tests that are positive will be greater as a function of the whole number of people we've tested.
Potthoff says the COVID-19 test is highly accurate and false negatives are unlikely, but he says they are possible in people who are asymptomatic. He noted asymptomatic individuals are not being tested in Wisconsin. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Under the stay-at-home order issued by the Evers administration this week, healthcare workers, including dentists, are considered essential, but the American Dental Association and the Wisconsin Dental Association recommend dentists suspend all non-emergency procedures. Dr. Patrick Teep is the immediate past president of the WDA. He says suspending services keeps patients and staff safe from COVID-19. Still, Teep says it has been difficult to turn patients away.
During normal times, we caution patients all the time to don't defer treatment because treatment can get worse, you know, tooth decay or periodontal disease. And so that is difficult. But these are different times than what we've ever experienced before.
The WDA says it will continue to encourage dentists to limit care to emergencies through at least April 24th. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio. You can get more news at any time by going to our website. That's WPR.org. It's 8:34 now.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a quick heads up here on our programming. Join us this evening for a special report with our partners at PBS Wisconsin. We hear from Wisconsin Supreme Court candidates Daniel Kelly and Jill Karofsky. That's ahead of the state's April 7th primary. And then we join Here and Now for a recap of this week's news in Wisconsin. That's tonight at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're talking about crisis communication amid the pandemic and how to talk frankly to the public. The CDC says in its guidelines that clear, accurate, and timely communication is key to keeping the general public informed about the pandemic. Have you seen conflicting reports, conflicting information about COVID-19? Have you encountered misinformation or misleading information? Have you had to convince a loved one that the information they had was unfounded? We're at 800-642-1234. Dominique Brossard is a professor and chair of the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison, where she studies science and risk communication. Dominique, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate. Glad to be here.
There is so much information that we're getting all at once. It's coming from all directions. And in a crisis like this, how do experts communicate the severity of the risk and actually convince people to take certain steps to protect themselves?
Yes, this is exactly the question we should ask ourselves. The main thing in this kind of crisis is to be consistent across sources of information. And as the CDC says, clear, concise, accurate, and transparency when you transmit the information is really key.
Yeah, and so in terms of how to get widespread behavior, such as social distancing, getting people to do everything and be on the same page about it, what type of communication must you give to people? How do you do that convincing?
Yeah, so it's difficult to convince people to change their behavior, particularly if the behavior you're asking them to adopt, such as physical distancing and so on, is a complicated one because it generates problems in the house, at work, etc. So what you need to do when you communicate about this kind of behavior is making sure that it's relevant to people's life, that they realize that what they're doing is for the safety of loved ones, for the community. Appeal to some emotions that will resonate and make them realize that at the end of the day, we are all on this together. Just by staying very dry and very disconnected from people's life will not work.
So let's look at facial masks for a moment. The CDC and the Surgeon General had said that healthy people didn't need to wear surgical masks and that wearing one wouldn't prevent COVID-19. But people bought them anyway. They bought them in droves online. And now we're seeing shortages in hospitals. And then other experts came out and argued that universal mask wearing was the right tactic. So help us understand those mixed messages there.
Yes, and I think that was a good and excellent example of a communication fiasco, because if you want to confuse people, obviously giving them information that doesn't match is going to increase the confusion and to some extent increase the worry of the people that are confronted with this information. So in the case of the mask, what happened is that people realize that something is happening that's very scary and it's a disease. And most of the time, masks are worn on hospital and so on, particularly on TV shows, right? Mm. If we think of Grey Anatomy and so on. So the natural reaction will be when you are confronted with something that's unknown, uncertain, and scary, is to do anything you can to protect you. And it may be even buying toilet paper for that matter, because you don't, are scared to run out of it. But in the case of the face masks, indeed, people believe their own instincts as far as what it meant to protect themselves and others. So they rush to buy the mask. And to some extent, you know, logic says that indeed masks work to protect people, right? Like that's like the logic. But is the same logic then say having an umbrella protect people even if it's not raining, or putting sunscreen works if you don't have sunshine? So yes, masks work if you are around people that are sick. But if you practice good physical distance, 6 feet between you and other people, if you are not around people that are sick, masks are not necessary. So I think that type of messaging would have been much useful to convey to the American people from the starting point.
Yeah, because as you mentioned there, people are trusting their gut feeling at first. They're trusting their instincts. Is there anything that public health agencies could do or could have done to prevent the hoarding?
Well, you know, several experts had actually claimed the same thing at some point. He's saying that you have to be clear of why you're asking people to do certain things. So we are going to adopt behaviors because we believe that the consequences of adopting the behavior are worthwhile. So if we can convince people that physical distancing is going to keep our community safe, they will do it. If we convince them that we will run out of those masks and that the medical community needs them when they are in the healthcare setting, then that would work. But, you know, like just saying that people don't need the mask was not the best way to handle the situation.
We're talking with Dominique Broussard, a professor of life sciences communication at UW-Madison. We're looking at crisis communication and how the public officials are handling this with their messaging to the American public about the pandemic. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Have you seen conflicting information out there about COVID-19? Where did you read it? Where did you hear about it? Have you noticed more misinformation or misleading information in this time of the pandemic? And how do you process it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a call on this now. Let's go to Tim, who's joining us from Birchwood. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
I was just calling because at my workplace, a week ago, I showed symptoms and didn't go to work on one day and called in, and they told me, I told them I had symptoms, but I felt I could work. So they told me, go ahead and return to work. You know, the symptoms weren't on the list, but my symptom was a sore throat and a slight cough. And I had called Marshfield. They told me maybe on the first day that I should call Marshfield Clinic, and I got the same information from Marshfield Clinic that the sore throat and the slight cough wasn't enough
to merit anything further. Sure. Yeah, yeah. So how do you feel about the communication you had between the clinic and also what your employer told you?
Well, I feel I was misinformed, that I should have took the 14-day quarantine, and because I still have the symptoms, and I returned to work, and other people are leaving and missing a day or two and returning to work, and I feel that the employer, you know, isn't protecting us enough against what's going on. People are leaving, worried about it.
Tim,
and returning
to work. Tim, do you feel like you have pressure to show up at work? Do you feel pressure to be there?
Yes.
Yeah.
They say our business is essential and nobody there can see it. I believe that, you know, as we return to work, we're a lot more chance of spreading this virus.
Well, Tim, thank you for sharing that situation. Dominique, what do you hear there as Tim worked with his employer, but also the clinic, Marshfield Clinic?
Yes, and I think Tim raised an extremely important point, and we haven't talked enough about it, I think, is what happens to employees that are in essential businesses and that are, to some extent, in between their employers, their family, you know, like information from doctors and so on. And how do they negotiate all these type of information coming from different part of the community? And I think, I mean, I commend Tim on wanting to protect his family, himself, his community. This is something that's extremely important. And I think local officials have to think in terms of sending clear guidelines to businesses that stay open in how to make sure, you know, like the employees are safe, and by the same token, their families and such that are in contact with them. Because this is to some extent lost in all the discussion. We are talking a lot about we need to be physically distancing ourselves, but what happened to people that go to work is something that we need to really think about.
Tim, thanks. Let's go to Karen now in Janesville. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I would like to ask, when the stores have been very nice about letting seniors come early before anyone else, but when there's so many people there and you can't be 6 feet away from someone, how is that not dangerous or not spreading?
Karen, thank you for that question. And Karen's referring to the special hours that some grocery stores and other pharmacies have set for seniors to come in and do their shopping. Dominique, what about those messages there?
Yeah, and she, Karen is exactly correct. We do have a wide range of conflict information in that context as well. And I think some stores have been better than others, you know, where they put signs on the floors to make sure that people know how close they are to each other, and other stores have not done that. I think there needs to be a push from local public health officials to make sure that the stores comply to putting clear signs so people know exactly how they can keep themselves safe while shopping.
We're looking at communication in times of crisis with Dominique Broussard, a UW-Madison Life Sciences communication professor. She studies risk communication. Threats can be abstract or can seem abstract until they become personal. When did you realize how risky COVID-19 is? What drove the message home for you? Be part of this discussion, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll talk more in a minute with Dominique Broussard right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC says any public health emergency presents significant risk communication challenges, and a pandemic, it's no different. It provides federal resources for health educators who do community outreach. So what has been the most helpful source of information for you when it comes to protecting your health and doing what you can to protect the health of others in this crisis? When you've disagreed with someone about the facts, what did you do? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Dominique Broussard is a UW-Madison Life Sciences communication professor, and she stays with us. Let's go to Timothy now, joining us from Superior. Hi, Timothy.
Hi, ma'am. How are you doing today?
Doing well. What would you like to add?
So I'm a small business owner. I've got three locations in northern Wisconsin. And what's really hard is the lack of communication from the government. Also, you know, dealing with, yes, these stimulus checks are going to be great and helpful, but until the government offers some sort of debt freeze, and I'm not asking for them to take my payment away, but just put it on the back end of my loan, because I have to, you know, it's really tough for me because I have to balance my employees' health with having to pay my bills. So I feel like I have to force my employees to come to work. So in the meantime, I've had two employees leave because they're scared. I've had to institute hazard pay, for my current employees just to stay to work, reduce hours, and it's just a very uncomfortable feeling. You know, I've implemented multiple policies and procedures on my own without any government
guidance.
Indication, guidance. Every person that comes through my door gets hand sanitizer. Every time someone leaves, the counters get all wiped down. We abide by the 10-foot, the 10-people rule, the 6-foot rule as much as we can, but it's a tough situation. I just wish the government would talk about a debt freeze rather than giving this money out. I don't want a free month of rent. I just put it on the end of my loan, and then I don't have to stay open.
Timothy, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Dominique, Timothy is making really difficult choices now for himself and his employees who he cares about, and he's feeling really alone in this, and a lot of it has to do with communication.
Yes, exactly. And I would like to thank Timothy for all the efforts he's put in trying not only to keep up on a business that's essential, so that's helping all of us, but also making sure that his employees are safe as well. That actually outlines the complexity of this kind of crisis. The problem is that we know that it is a health crisis, and the first instinct of everyone is to communicate about health. But in crisis, health, dimensions, we have consequences for business, we have consequences for education, we have consequences for all the stakeholders that are involved. And that means that in crisis management, technically, and that means that when we are prepared to face them, we need to have a process for all those involved, for all the stakeholders, because it's our duty in terms of when I'm saying as far as the government is concerned, it's our duty to make sure that people feel they are in control and they have the means to address a situation that's extremely complex. And only clear communication guidelines and content that are transparent and consistent, that take into account everyone that's involved, all the roles that we play, including the media, by the way. The media has a big role to play in actually giving very good science-based information that's consistent. So this has to be the case for all of us.
Yeah, we've certainly felt that weight as we try to verify every single thing that we say, that we put out there, knowing that it certainly has an effect. Let's bring in David now in Ironwood with thoughts on this. Hi, David.
Yes, I think people just need to pay more attention to the facts and stuff. It's just, there's a lot of young people say, well, it's not going to really affect them. But it will affect the older folks. And, when I was younger, I used to be a great relationship between me and my grandfather and grandmother and stuff. I mean, some of the people don't even know their older folks or whatever. And the same thing with a lot of older folks, they're voting.
Yeah.
Oh, climate change is not going to hurt us.
David,
who cares?
Yeah, David, thank you for the call. And I think he's getting at here that people might feel invincible, and no one is invincible with COVID-19.
Yes, exactly. And COVID-19 represents exactly what a risk issue represents when it generates fear, or potentially it generates, incredulity. The problem that we have is we really don't see this virus. And right now, we keep on talking about the fact that we want to prevent its spread, but a lot of communities right now, and thankfully we hope that it's going to continue that way, do not know someone that has died from the virus, or does not know someone that has clear symptoms. So it seems very abstract, and it seems that it's not really real, that we're fighting something that's unknown, and not easy to track. And that's how people react to these kind of things. They tend to have a hard time actually taking it seriously until it matters to them. And the caller actually brought up a very important point. So those youngsters that have grandparents that they like, for them, it's going to be useful to remind them, hey, you know what? You are in charge of protecting those folks. For other youngsters, it may be another message that's going to resonate. It may be protecting their mother. It may be protecting their best friend. It may be making sure they have jobs in 6 months because we want to have an economy that is still afloat. So the key is, though, to find something that resonates with people's feelings to make them realize that at the end of the day, we are in this all together.
We're talking with Dominique Broussard, looking at crisis communication. She's a professor of life sciences communication at UW-Madison. Let's take another call in this. Nick is here from Madison. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just a little explanation why the cases will increase because they haven't done enough testing. I went on vacation. I was in Spain for 8 days, France for 4. When I got back, 2 days later, I started getting symptoms. 4 days later, I was sicker than a dog. I called my doctor's office over a week and a half period to get tested. And I also called Dane County. Each time, I was given excuses of not needing my test. One was I didn't come from a country of concern. I didn't. Two, I had a dry cough, and I wasn't bringing anything up. And when I called back, I said I was bringing tons of stuff up from my lungs.
Nick, how? Yeah, oh, Nick.
Let me close out here. And I asked, finally, I asked, what would it take for me to get tested? And they said, if you're home and you can't take care of yourself anymore, have someone drive you to the emergency room. That was when I could get tested.
Well, Nick, thank you for sharing your story. I'm hoping you're doing so much better. Dominique, it seems that we're hearing so many different stories about how communication is critical and communication is really difficult.
Yes, exactly. And I think the testing situation is another one that's very complicated. And thank you to the caller. I hope he's feeling better now. And there is that idea that going back to the point we were outlining before, what makes this complex crisis communication context, you know, difficult to communicate? In this case, we don't like unknown. We like to feel in control. We like to know what's ahead of us. We like to have clear answers. We like to know exactly when this will all end. Well, the thing though, we don't know all those answers. So what we need right now from the public health officials is to be clear about the uncertainty, is to be clear to say what they are working on, and they're working on vaccines, and they're working on getting masks, and they're working on getting all those test kits ready. So this is certainty. We know that all this happened. I think it's important to make the public realize what we know and what we're doing and the things that we don't know yet, because this is something that also generates trust. We cannot test everybody right now, but we would like to know what kind of disease we have if we have it, right? But we cannot, because the fact is that there's not enough tests. And when we have a flu in general, we stay at home, right? We don't get tested, but it's completely understandable that people want to know what they have. But the reality is that the government does not have enough tests.
So Dominique, I'm sorry, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dominique Brossard, a professor and chair of the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.